The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We are on iTunes, we're on Stitcher, we're on Amazon. Any way you consume your podcast, you can find us under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook, Writers on Writing, Twitter, WOWKUCIFM. You can follow us on our websites. Barbara's is penonfire.com. Mine is mariestone.com. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, whatever else comes up. 14 years ago, around the time I first started doing the show with Barbara, I had AJ Jacobs on the show to talk about a book a lot of you may have likely heard of, The Year of Living Biblically. I have followed him since then, but I haven't had the chance to welcome him back. Today is that day. AJ is an author, journalist, lecturer, and human guinea pig. He has written numerous New York Times bestsellers that combine memoir, science, humor, and a dash of self-help. His biography is way too long and ridiculous to recount, but you may remember him from his first 2004 bestseller, The Know-It-All, where he spent 18 months reading the Encyclopedia Britannica. As I mentioned, he was on the show in 2007 after he spent a year living biblically. He went on to attempt to become the world's healthiest man in Drop Dead Healthy and to construct the planet's largest family tree in It's All Relative. That resulted in a family reunion that drew thousands of folks and raised a significant amount of money for Alzheimer's research. He's written for every prominent magazine out there. He does podcasts. He regularly commentates on NPR. He's done a ton of TED Talks. He's appeared on all sorts of television talk shows, including Oprah, CNN, Conan, and Colbert. Anyway, suffice to say, you'll feel like a colossal loser after you read the first paragraph of his bio. And yet he's extremely humble. He's self-deprecating. He claims to be easily distractible. So we're going to delve into how someone accomplishes so many superhuman writing feats while presenting like a regular guy. To give you a small sense of this, actually, one essay that AJ wrote in 2005, My Outsourced Life, went on to inspire and be included in Tim Ferriss's famous 4-Hour Workweek. And that was just kind of some throwaway piece for AJ. So that gives you a sense of this. His latest is Thanks a Thousand, A Gratitude Journey, where he undertakes the task of thanking every person along the vast chain of folks responsible for his morning cup of coffee. This book came out of a TED Books collaboration, I think, which I ignorantly didn't know was a thing before this. So hopefully we get to talk about that too. Anyway, AJ, welcome back.
Thank you for that lovely introduction. It is great to be back. I was getting worried that I had offended you or something, but glad I made it back on the air.
Well, I am sorry. It has taken me 14 years to have you back on the show. I'm embarrassed, but delighted. So
I am delighted. Well, we have lots to talk about.
We do. So as I was prepping for this interview, which felt vast, given the territory you've covered, I thought, you know, I've got a big body of material here. How the hell do I organize it? So I was thinking of, you know, what would AJ do? So that's become my new mantra. WWAJD.
Oh my goodness. Well, my wife would not think that's a good idea, but I'm very flattered.
Well, I figure your life is like the adage of, you know, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? So I figure that's what we'll do. We'll do that. So I thought we could start way back at the beginning, because I know your dad was a lawyer and he holds this distinction for the most footnotes in a law review article, 4,812.
That's it. I come a family obsessed with words and writing and nerds, proud nerds. And he is the world record holder. And I just talked to him about it. He says it'll probably never be broken.
It will never be broken. No. I suffered through a law review article of my own and I went back and looked at it and I only had 257 footnotes. So I feel kind of super inadequate.
I'm sure your readers actually preferred that. But
I would just love to hear about, you know, kind of starting there, growing up under, as you say, these word nerds, book nerds. Like, was there a sense that you drew from his sustained focus and attention or?
Yeah, I mean, both of my parents are big readers and writers. And in fact, I'm writing a book right now on my love of puzzles, especially word puzzles. And one of the anecdotes in the introduction is that My father was in the army in Korea as a lawyer. He wasn't on the front lines, but he and my mother had, sounds to me like the least efficient way to solve a crossword puzzle, because she would fill in one clue, send it to him in Korea. She was in New Jersey, and it probably took him 3 years to finish a crossword puzzle. But that gives you a sense of my background, and I'm super grateful for it.
I remember there was a story in the Know It All where you were talking about your attempt to perfect like playing wall ball, and you would just spend hours and hours trying to get the ball in the right spot. And I thought, you know, that little anecdote was such a great foreshadowing for what you went on to do, which is just time at task.
Well, thank you for remembering that. That is love. Yeah, I do feel that I was born with some OCD tendencies. I'm feel lucky that I've been able to channel them into, I don't know, some people wouldn't say it's productive, but I've been able to channel them into making a living at the very least.
So you got your start in journalism. I can't remember if you got your degree in journalism and then started. Tell me a little bit about the path into writing and finding this genre.
Yeah, I actually did not. I got a degree in philosophy, which I think is what you got from reading your bio. Is that right?
That is right. Yeah.
There you go.
Right.
We can talk philosophy if I remember any. Yeah, as you might have noticed, there were not a lot of jobs for philosophers at the time when I graduated. Right. The only thing that I could sort of do was to string a few sentences together. And I started working for very small local newspapers, writing about anything they would let me in. Sewage. I wrote a lot of articles about that, the PTA, the usual. And then I built from there to writing for magazines and longer until I got that first book.
Well, I've always thought of you as like the George Plimpton of our generation. We're about the same age, but George was like 60s or 70s, I think.
Well, that's very flattering. I'm a big fan of his.
I am too. But he really seemed like, I don't know if he was one of the first that I think of in this kind of experiential journalism or immersion journalism, I guess they call it. So tell me about finding that as your genre.
Yeah, he was great. I mean, he did slightly different immersions. He would join a professional baseball team for a game or get punched in the face by a heavyweight boxer. And I'm less interested in the physical pain, but I do enjoy putting myself in socially interesting, awkward, or unusual situations. Yeah, I took the advice of my writing teachers who say, write what you know. But the problem is I didn't feel that I knew very much. So I thought, well, one way to get around that would be to put myself in these unusual situations. And one of the first ones I did actually was I was working at Entertainment Weekly magazine, writing about movies and TV. And this was a long time ago. And I looked very much like sort of a B-list movie star. He's very talented, but his name was Noah Taylor. And I was a dead ringer for him. And turned out he was not going to the Academy Awards, even though his movie was nominated. It was called Shine. It was about a pianist. So anyway, I went. I never even said that I was Noah Taylor, but I looked so much like him that the paparazzi went crazy. I signed autographs. And so the whole idea was, what's it like to be a movie star for a night? And I got to say, it's pretty great. It is pretty great. You get to see how these movie stars get insane egos, because I was only a movie star for a night and somehow my ego ballooned.
Didn't you practice radical honesty at some point? I love this contradiction of signing autographs and practicing radical honesty.
Well, that is true. To be fair, I did not sign Noah Taylor. I just signed Shine On, which was
the
name of the movie. But yeah, I did do an experiment called Radical Honesty based on this psychologist who believes that we should, whatever, he says that you should not lie, but he goes further. He says that whatever is on your brain should come out of your mouth, no filter. So I thought this was an interesting philosophy, and I tried it for about 3 months, and it was, it was some of the worst 3 months of my life. It was really, there is a reason for that filter, but there were also wonderful moments. So I don't want to say that it was fully negative, because I hope none of my projects are a waste of time. I hope that I'm always able to take something out of it. That one I really did. You know, I'm not going to do the traditional "you look fat in that dress" ever again. But I do feel that radical positive honesty or radical constructive honesty. Something like, you know, calling an old mentor from that tiny newspaper I was talking about and telling him how much he means to me. That kind of honesty, I think, is we need more of.
Well, it's interesting because I was trying to sort of track the arc of your career. And I was thinking about this. All of your projects are very disparate and different from each other. But I was trying to trace sort of the through lines. And there are a lot of through lines. I mean, I think your concern is partly about interconnectedness, right? A lot of these books are about that.
I love that. Thank you for noticing. That really is one of the biggest themes of all of my books and articles. Yeah.
And radical self-improvement. I mean, I thought if I was going to sit down to do this, I'd be, you know, the year of drinking whiskey or, you know, something not so hard.
Nothing wrong with that. I would read that.
Your books are so hard. I mean, I feel like the hardest part is doing the work. And, you know, usually I say the writing is definitely the hardest part, but the hardest part is sitting down to read the Encyclopedia Britannica or, you know, so.
Yes. Although I will say it wasn't just hard on me. It was hard on, you know, my wife started to penalize me $1 for every irrelevant fact I inserted into conversation. So I want to thank her for putting up with that.
I love it. Yes, but I thought we could spend a few minutes just talking about your generation of the ideas for a couple of these books. And because the other thing that I was thinking of was where we were in time when these books came out. So the Know-It-All came out at a time when the internet was really gaining a lot of traction and we were starting to get information overload. And I can't remember when disinformation really entered the lexicon, but to go back to books, to go back to the physical Encyclopedia Britannica while we're being flooded with internet information, you could kind of trace, you know, and your project with building the family tree felt like it kind of came out when everybody was going out to get a DNA test in their house. So I was trying to kind of track your projects to what was going on in the external world. And I don't know if I'm doing it right. You know, I don't know if that was on your brain too, but maybe we just talk about the generation of some of those
sure.
big ideas.
Well, first of all, thank you for making me seem smarter than I am and that I was somehow on top of the zeitgeist. I think I just lucked out in several occasions. I think a lot about idea generation, and I think it's the most important thing for a writer. It's our lifeblood. So my ideas come from several different sources. One is just my life. I'm always have that sort of second pair of eyes where I'm saying I'm living my life, but I'm also saying, well, could this be an interesting project or article or book? So that first one you mentioned, the Know-It-All, my father started to read the encyclopedia when I was a kid, but he didn't quite finish. He made it to the middle of the letter B, like Borneo or somewhere. And that was the generation of that. I thought, well, what if I finished what he began and, you know, remove that mark from our family history? A lot of them are, I will see a phenomenon and I'll say, what can I do? What would that look like if I took it to almost the logical extreme, the reductio ad absurdum? So another one you mentioned was the My Outsourced Life. This was right at the start of outsourcing. I had read the Tom Friedman book, The World is Flat, and it was all about how these huge companies were outsourcing their sort of menial tasks. And I was just a writer. I don't have a huge company. It's just me. But I thought, well, what if I tried that? What would that look like? So what if I outsourced writing my emails and arguing with my wife? And so it became a fascinating experiment. And again, I feel even though I took it to the extreme, there were lessons to be learned. I'm not going to outsource my arguments for the rest of my life, but it was really illuminating. And the other part of idea generation that I just want to stress is I do generate a lot of ideas, but I would estimate, you know, 97-98% of them are terrible. So I really do feel creativity is a numbers game. It's like you've got to generate a lot to find the golden nugget. You know, there's going to be a lot of dirt, a lot of sand. in addition to the gems. And I actually have a practice where every morning for 10, 15 minutes, I just generate ideas. And sometimes I just look at a magazine and I'll come up with ideas that, knowing that I'm not going to use 98% of them, but just I love flexing that muscle. I love keeping my brain as fluid as possible.
And how do you know when you've hit upon the right one? Because I can just imagine myself saying, I should sit down and read the encyclopedia. And then way before your dad, but around the time I got to Aardvark, I'd be like, that's not going to work.
Well, in terms of knowing, which ones to pursue, there are a couple of methods I use. One is that if I think there's a good idea, I tell people and I really look at their eyes and see, do their eyes light up? They may not tell you the truth, but you can tell by their body language if they're engaged and if they ask questions. I also, it's a lot about if the idea keeps bubbling up in my brain, like 3 weeks later, hey, remember that idea I had? Maybe there is something to it. And then the other part of your question seemed to be, how do I stick to it? And that is also a challenge. One part that does motivate me, and I did this during my book on health, I would publicly announce, I'm going to lose 10 pounds. And so there's this sort of accountability. So I'd say, I'm going to live a year following all the rules of the Bible. I'm not going to shave my beard. I'm not going to, covet. And so putting that out there for all my friends and family, if I buckle, there's a level of embarrassment and humiliation. So that keeps me going.
It sounds like your son came up with the idea for this latest one.
That's right. Exactly. So again, ideas can come from anywhere. And this one, I can tell the story if
please. If you want.
I'm very interested in just the concept of gratitude because there is so much research that it's really good for you mentally, physically. There are all these studies about how it actually helps you recover more quickly from illness and helps ward off depression. So I tried to start this gratitude practice where before dinners, I would say to my family, I want to acknowledge the people who helped make this meal possible. I want to thank the farmer who grew the tomatoes and the cashier at the grocery store who sold me the tomatoes. And my son, who was about 10 at the time, pointed out correctly that this was kind of lame because those people weren't getting anything out of it. They weren't in our apartment. So if I really cared, I would go and thank them in person. And I thought to myself, that is a very interesting idea for a project, for a book. And that sort of set me off. And I did. I chose coffee because it's one of my basic necessities. And I decided to try to thank everyone who had even the smallest role in making my morning cup of coffee from this coffee shop in New York. I took it wide because, as we mentioned, it's all about interconnection. So I thanked the barista, but I went to South America and I thanked the farmers. But that was just the start. There are hundreds of people in between that are almost invisible that we take for granted. In anything, it doesn't have to be coffee, but the truck driver who drove the coffee beans, and he couldn't have done his job without the streets. So I thanked the people who paved the street, and the logo designer. I called up the logo designer. I called up the woman who did pest control for the warehouse where the coffee beans are stored to thank her for keeping the insects out of my coffee. She was like, this is a very weird conversation. But she also said, this is very nice. I don't get a lot of positive feedback in my job. So it was a wonderful experiment in, as you say, interconnection and in really forcing myself to focus on the hundreds of things that go right every day, as opposed to my default, which is to focus on the three or four that go wrong.
Mine too.
I think, unfortunately is the human wiring.
Well, it's really fun to recommend this book, not only to people for the gratitude portion of it, but also the lovers of coffee, right? I mean, there's just a lot of coffee history in here, or not history, coffee facts and factoids that I had I just had no idea the design of the lid or the, you know, how coffee beans are picked or what they even looked like. So you could read this book on many levels. I mean, you can read it from a writerly point of view, which is one point of view I always do it from, the gratitude point of view, the coffee nerd point of view. The other thing that runs through a lot of your work that, you know, maybe because we're fellow philosophy majors, but your interest in altruism and sort of moral ethics, I think, is there in every piece you do, and certainly in this piece, and grappling with the ethics of there's a lot of exploitation and globalization for all the good it does. And that seems to have been on your mind for years and years.
I love that. But two things. Let me just go back to the coffee nerdery for 1 second, because I do want to plug my favorite word that I learned during this, which was ZARF, Z-A-R-F. I don't know if you remember, but that is the official name for the cardboard sleeve that goes around your coffee cup to keep your fingers from burning. And it has a long history. There were ancient Chinese zarfs made of gold. And so I love the zarf. But thank you for asking about it. Yeah, the altruism has been a big part of my life. And as you say, it's a complicated topic, this production of a cup of coffee, because there's great joy in the making of coffee, but there's also great suffering. And I wanted to try to acknowledge it all. And the question was, is gratitude, does that actually help make the world better? Does that inspire us to try to fix the problems? Or is it a recipe for complacency? And there are people who argue that there's this downside to gratitude. From my point of view, and from the research that I read, it actually, gratitude does make you want to pay it forward. It makes you more altruistic. And just to give you one quick example from my own life, I have a whole section on water, because coffee is 98.8% water, just a little bean juice, bean dust, and the rest is water. And I live in New York City, and I went a couple hours north to the reservoir that supplies New York, and it is mind-blowing. There are hundreds of people who keep that reservoir working. There's engineers and chemists and people who wade out into freezing cold water in February. There's the community, which I didn't realize this, but basically New York was growing so fast, they needed a place for water, and they just wiped out an entire town and put the reservoir on top of it. So there's still some residual bitterness from the people in the area, because New York just took over. It really drove home that water, the fact that we can turn this little metal spigot and get clean, drinkable water, I take that for granted, and I think most people do. But it is a remarkable, unbelievable, I don't want to say miracle, but it's a near miracle. And it was not true for 99% of human history. It's still not true for billions of people around the world who have to travel hours to get clean water. So just realizing how amazing it is that I can have water, it inspired me to look into what are the best charities to help other people in developing countries get water. And I found some great ones. And I tell my kids occasionally to eye rolls, but there's the cliche of looking at the glass half empty or half full. And my take is that is maybe not the best way to frame it. I don't think we should be trying to figure out whether it's half full or half empty. We should just be amazed that there is any water in the glass at all. Because as I said, this was not true for most of human history.
Well, I think our listeners are getting the idea of how much research and how many people you talk to that went into this book. So in terms of like structuring all of this, I think a writer's greatest procrastination tool is research. I mean, I could research something until I die and never write a word about it and be totally happy with it. So tell me a little bit about that process. If you do all of the research up front, or if you kind of know where you're going and you're writing and outlining as you go, tell me a little bit about, I mean, I just imagine that your office would be full of interviews and factoids about all kinds of water and different articles. So tell me a little bit about organizing all of this, structuring it, and how all of that info gets turned into a book.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I love the research. I like it much better than the writing. The writing I find very lonely and tough. But the research I love. I love just learning and talking, especially if it's interviewing people. And yeah, so I research a tremendous amount and I just write down everything I can, mostly before I start writing. But what you brought up was, to me, the most important thing is structure, because I try to get a structure early on, because without a structure, I'm lost. There's just too many options. And I've been lucky that my books have sort of naturally had these very constrained structures, but that have allowed me to also be creative within them. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, my first book was about the encyclopedia. So I did it chapter A, chapter B, chapter C, chapter D. And I would have, you know, my favorite facts about the words in those. But I also used it as a way to structure the memoir part of that book. So if I wanted to talk about my relationship with my father, I could do it under Freud, you know, under chapter F for Freud. With this book on thanking everyone for coffee, I decided early on I needed a structure. So I structured it in terms of different parts of the supply chain, all the transportation, because you need ships, you need trucks, you need, you know, the pallets. I couldn't believe there was so much to learn about pallets and how the world could not live without these shipping pallets. So that would be one. And water would be another chapter. The cup, I had a whole chapter on the cup and the design of the lid. I talked to the designer. And just to give you one last example, I had always wanted to write a book about health and trying to be healthy, but I could never figure out the structure. Until finally I said, well, what if I did it by body part? So I could do one chapter on the heart and talk a lot about exercise and the stomach. I could talk about eating, but it would also cause some more creative. You know, I have a section on hands, and, you know, we don't think about hand health, but there are some fascinating things to learn about it. You know, I had a whole section on, I won't get into too much detail, but the lower end of the digestion process, because that is a big part of life. So I had a section on, I don't remember whether it was the butt or I used some other word, but that was what broke it open, is I was able to structure it in a very particular way.
I assume you allow yourself the element of surprise, right? Because that's, I always find that if something is too heavily outlined, the reader can also guess along with the writer, because that's just how life works. So do you allow yourself, as you're doing the research, I assume something comes up and you're like, what?
Oh, yeah. Well, I love that you say that, because, yeah, I would say the element of surprise is crucial in several different ways. One, as you say, in the research. So I'll be researching and I'll just see a line about something, like, I don't know, my new book is about puzzles. So I just saw some line about a guy who was obsessed with one particular Lewis Carroll riddle, and he spends, you know, years researching it. And it's like, oh, I got to talk to this guy. So, yes, being open to that. And in the writing, being open to a little bit of surprise, where, you know, I want to know where the chapter starts and I kind of have a sense of where it ends. But within that, I like to take interesting detours. I also feel that just writing sentences, I once, I was friends with a guy who was a writer for The Daily Show, and we were talking about writing. And he said to him, the most important thing was to be able to surprise yourself as a writer, that, you know, you start a sentence and then by the end, you've surprised yourself with a twist. And it's a little bit nonsensical, because how do you surprise yourself? But it's also, I understand it, and I've felt that, and I love that feeling when I'm in the middle of a sentence and I just sort of take this turn that I didn't expect.
I'm so glad you said that, because I talk to a lot of writers, especially writers in the thriller and mystery genre, because I'm like, how do you keep doing that? Because every mystery book has been written under the sun, and how do you keep surprising yourself? Nobody can really explain it, because you just have to do it. But yes, yeah. It's hard. I mean, you have to kind of discard the first 18 things that come quickly to your mind, because that's what's going to come to everybody else's mind. Maybe it's just the process of doing it and doing it and doing it. I don't know. But
yeah. No, I agree that I think there's a phrase, I think it was when I interviewed Tina Fey, she said, she taught me the phrase, first thought, worst thought, first thought. And that's not always true. Sometimes your first thought is great, but I find usually, yeah, don't go with your first thought. You got to keep digging to surprise yourself.
Well, it sounds like that's part of your generation process for the ideas too, right? You'll write down 800 things, as you say, and those are out. Eventually something.
Exactly. Yeah. The more that you can generate, the more you have to choose from.
My guest this morning is AJ Jacobs. The book is Thanks a Thousand, A Gratitude Journey. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. How far do you have to flesh it out? Because let's take your latest book on puzzles. You know, I can imagine writing down the word puzzle and then I'd be like,
There are several stages. I might do a brainstorm session on all the different types of puzzles, or, you know, what is a puzzle? What is similar to a puzzle? Like, is, you know, marriage a puzzle? Is buying a car a puzzle? So there's that. And in terms of, I know some of your listeners are writers, so I'm happy to talk about my process because it is kind of unusual. I'm not sure that a lot of people do it this way, but it works for me, which is I'm a big outliner, as you say. So I'll outline almost a skeletal outline, like here are the beats of the chapter that I want to cover. But then instead of trying to write it fully, which always intimidates me, just the blank page, I'll say, well, here are the bones. Let me just try to fill in a little bit, like a muscle here, a muscle there. Like, here's a phrase, maybe not even a full sentence. Here's like a metaphor I want to use, and I'll put that in the outline. And that'll be like the second outline. Then I'll do it again for a third outline. And sometimes it takes me like 12 outlines. But by the end, I have what's almost a written through chapter. And then using that, I write through a clean version.
And then at that point, at somewhere in that point, do you try and figure out, because all of your books have some bigger theme, like something bigger at stake. So the gratitude book, it's very interesting to follow all of the detail nuances of, you know, the architecture of the cup and the idea of gratitude. But, you know, when you come away from the book, there's a lot of big ideas in there about psychology and philosophy and altruism, how to live a good life, what the impact is on the planet, all of these kind of big issues that are really woven through, you know, like a filament in the fabric that you wouldn't even know is there necessarily when you're reading it. And you come away saying, oh my gosh, there was, you know, that was kind of a big idea book.
Well, I love that.
Tell me when that comes.
Well, that I think is all throughout, because I do think as a reader, I think my brain and a lot of human brains, you know, we get bored easily. We want different things. We're attracted to novelty. So when I'm reading, I like when there's sort of a switch in perspective. So that I do that a lot in my books. I'll go really close in on, you know, the czar for the, you know, the design of the lid. And then after a page of that, I say, okay, now it's time to zoom out and say, you know, what does this all mean? Is there a bigger point about the design of mundane objects, which is kind of what I talked about in that. And I try to do it with other aspects of the book too. So I'll do a section on memoir, you know, about my own experience with coffee, but then I'll say, let's take a moment to talk about the deep history of coffee and how it was the legend has it, there was a goat herd in Ethiopia who saw his goats jumping around. So trying to zoom in, zoom out, zoom in, zoom out, to keep the reader and myself interested.
You also are really wonderful at embedding a little bit of writerly advice or creativity advice into all of your work, which I appreciate. Oh. But you did a great, I don't know if it was a TED Talk, you did a great talk a while back on the importance of self-delusion and creativity. I guess the ultimate point is faking it till you make it.
Right.
In your creative process. And I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's I was just thinking about that yesterday. So let me give you the background really quickly, which was I have long believed that when you embark on something like a book, it's so intimidating, or starting a company, that the chances of failure are so high that you do have to delude yourself a bit into being overly optimistic and say, I can do this. When I was writing the book on health, for instance, I would wake up many mornings just filled with despair because it's such a big topic. There's so much, and I didn't go to medical school, but I would, as you say, fake it till I felt it. So I would pretend to be optimistic. I would call the top doctor in whatever field. I would call the publisher and say, hey, I had a great idea for this. When the book comes out, we could serve kale martinis at the book party. And after acting like this for a couple of hours, I would actually start to believe, I would become more optimistic. And there's a quote that I love. I've used it in at least one book, which is that it's easier to act your way into a new way of thinking than to think your way into a new way of acting. So that is, I love that. But I just do want to balance it, because I do think that delusional optimism has a downside. And that's one of my obsessions, is that everything has upsides and downsides. So I don't recommend it exclusively. I think you need some part of your brain, which is about realism, because we've seen the dangers of delusional optimism. If you've never been in politics and instead been a game show host, and you're deluded into thinking you're going to be a good leader, that did not work out, in my opinion. And I'm reading a wonderful book right now called The Scout Mindset. I highly recommend it, Julia Galef. And she talks about that maybe even when you're starting a business, you should be careful with your delusional optimism. So there's a balance, but I have found it very useful as a tool.
Maybe the analogy is to be delusional while you're creating and temper it when you're editing. Right.
I love that. Like the Hemingway quote, write drunk and edit sober.
Exactly. Go back and look at everything with a careful eye after you do all that.
That's great.
At what point do you kind of employ the inner critic? You know, because it feels like you give yourself a lot of room to play at the beginning and, you know, follow your enthusiasms and do all of this. And then through the massaging of the outline, it sounds like by the time you finish, you have a pretty good draft of what's going to be out there. But I don't know if in the editing process, it gets really reshaped all over again.
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, like you say, I do try to turn down the inner critic while I'm writing, but then when I'm reading it over, I try to allow that inner critic to have a say. I'm also a big fan of, I don't know whether you want to call it focus grouping or workshopping. So I have a very specific practice where I have about 10, 15 friends who I trust their taste. And I will send them a first draft of my book. And I will ask them, each of them, I'll say, please tell me, say 10 parts that you loved and 10 parts that were just, you thought were really slow and boring. And then I don't make a spreadsheet, but in my mind, I make a spreadsheet, because if, you know, 7 of them say, well, this part was pretty slow, that gives me a sense, you know what, this needs either to go or needs to be reworked. And I do that because I think that people have their own idiosyncrasies. So if I just gave it to one person, that could be dangerous, because maybe they are particularly fascinated with Zarfs and most people are not. So that's why I like to send it to 10 or 15 friends from different backgrounds, different interests, different jobs, and see what resonates.
Your family gets pulled into a lot of these. Certainly your wife gets pulled into a lot of these. I don't know if she's one of your critics who gets to commentate on this. You're certainly harder on yourself than you ever are on anyone else. So that, I'm sure that helps, but
it's true. Well, she does get full veto power. So there are, I have written about our sex life, but sometimes she pulls it back a little, which is probably good. I'm sure readers are grateful to her for her good taste.
Not me, but no, I get it. You said something earlier that I forgot to pick up on that I wanted to go back to, and the notion is reframing. And I think you've talked about reframing in a couple of different talks, and you talked about it earlier today, but I think it's important. I think it's important for writers. I think it's important just for how we live our lives. Mm. But this idea of reframing, you said you had to do it with marketing because you hate marketing books. And in today's day and age of publishing, so much of the onus is now on the writer to do that. But talk a little bit about frames and if that plays a role in the writing and creative process of how you view your work at various stages, if you have to kind of reframe it for yourself, or just if there's anything else you can say about that topic. I'm kind of intrigued by it.
Sure. Well, one thought that occurs to me is just the importance of reframing parts of your life that are unpleasant or disastrous or depressing, and try. I think it was Nora Ephron's famous quote, "Everything is material." Is that hers?
Yep.
And
I wrote that down, actually. I that was one of my questions, is everything in your life is material. Yes. Yeah.
Well, my wife is able to say not everything, but I do feel that has been really good for my mental health, is to be able to take something that's terrible and try to reframe it as a story, and by telling it, you can have some control back. You can get some control back in the narrative. And I'll just give you one example. I call it a self Schadenfreude, because it's this feeling when something bad is happening to you, at least you have some part of your mind that's saying, "Oh, this is going to be good to write about." And I think I've written about this, but for my very first book, when I was young, as mid-20s, and I was living in California, and I didn't know anything about the publishing business, and I sent a proposal to just a bunch of agents that I found in this book. I don't even know if it still exists, called Writer's Market. And I found one who said he was interested, and he said that a publisher was interested. But the publisher wanted to see a photo. This was before Google image search. And I said, "Why would they?" And he said, "Oh, just, in case you go on a talk show, they want to make sure you don't have two heads." And I said, "All right." So I went to Walmart and got a photo taken, and I sent it to him. And he called back 2 days later and said, "Well, they're going to pass." And I was like, "What? I'm not attractive enough to be an author? I thought that was one of the only jobs. Like, it didn't matter." So it was totally humiliating and soul crushing. But looking back, it was I was able to write about it, and it's so absurd now that I enjoy telling it as a story. And I guess the little button is that the publisher who rejected me for that very first book is Crown Publishing, which is actually the publisher of my upcoming book. And they are wonderful. They're different people, I am I'm quite sure. So, but they've been very good to me, and don't mind the way I look.
That's random. Sorry, I'm just trying to gather my thoughts about that weird story. Well, you have a great ability to do that, because there was something I was reading about, some weird criticism you got about the know-it-all. And by the way, if you guys haven't picked up the know-it-all, it's first of all, it's hilarious, and it's just wonderful. It's completely unexpected.
Thank you, Marie.
But you had turned some piece of criticism into a wonderful article in response to the critics. And I thought, this is such a great example of what you need to do as a writer, which is not internalize criticism and make use of it in some way, or you just would stop, right? You'd just be too soul-crushed. Because if you're like me, and I think you have said this, if you get 100 pieces of praise, you'll hear the one guy who said, it wasn't my cup of tea, and that's all you'll hear, right?
So. Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think that is the only way to keep sane, is to lean into it and acknowledge and vulnerability, I think, can be a sign of strength. If instead of trying to ignore criticism or get super angry and stew about it, instead just try to acknowledge how weird that experience can be and what you learn from it.
So as you look back over the last couple of decades of writing and publishing and speaking and the body of work that you have produced, do you sort of feel your areas of concern or your writerly urgency have changed, especially, you know, with what we with what we've all been through the last year or 4 years or whatever? Has that shifted? Does that kind of stuff, or, you know, just the process of growing older or parenthood or any of that, kind of shift your center of gravity from what you feel like it used to be to something, you know, something else?
I do. You know, when I look back on who I was in my 20s, I don't think if I met that guy I don't go to bars, but if I met him on a park bench, I'd be like, that guy is really, you know, kind of shallow and obsessed with himself. And I still, you know, I am still shallow and obsessed with myself, because I think, unfortunately, that is the way human brains are wired. But I fight against it. I really fight against it. And I do feel I am more motivated now than I ever was to try to think about other people and making their lives better. So I will tell you, as I mentioned, I hate the actual act of writing. So, but I've been in the middle of it for this book. So I'm writing, like, I wake up at say 8 and I start writing from 9 to 1, and I try not to be distracted from 9 to 1. And it is, as I say, lonely and depressing. But one motivator that I always think about is I am hopeful that this book will not only entertain people, but will have a nice message about curiosity and about the importance of, there's a parenting book I read once that said, don't get furious, get curious. When your kid is throwing a tantrum, don't yell at them. Just be like, what's going on in his or her mind? So that's a big theme of my book, is curiosity. And so it may be delusional on my part, but I genuinely think that this book will make people's lives better. And that gives me the energy to continue writing.
I'm so glad you used the word curiosity, because that was another word that I jotted down as the through line through all of your books, is obviously you're driven by that. And I think that's such an important tool, maybe one of the most important tools for writers, is to remain curious and to keep your eyes out of your own head and into the world. And I don't know if that drives your work more than the publishing contract. I mean, I'm sure that you have signed. I'm sure the books are the motivation to get all of these projects done, and that's the ticking time bomb, and the, you know, our hero has to accomplish this goal in a year.
Exactly. Well, no, I agree. Curiosity is huge. And I think it's one of my favorite virtues. I remember when I was at Esquire magazine, I interviewed Alex Trebek, the host of Jeopardy, who was lovely. Two things. First of all, he cursed like a sailor. I don't know whether he was trying to just, you know, trying to fit in with Esquire. But I was delighted to see that he had this other side to his polite Canadian persona. But he was also full of wisdom. And one of the things he said that I still remember, he said, I am curious about everything, even those things that don't interest me. And again, it's a little paradoxical, oxymoronic, but I love it. I love it. I agree. I feel that if I dug deep on whatever's the most stereotypically boring, accounting, if I dug deep on it, I'm sure there's so much fascinating world of tragedy and comedy and meaning in the world of accounting. So to me, that is, curiosity is what drives me.
Am I right about this, that a lot of some of the books come out of article projects or essays that you have done?
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to think if that is actually true, but it certainly is. Well, I did do a book which was sort of a collection of articles. So it had the one about outsourcing, and it had the one about radical honesty. So yes, you could be right. I'm just not. It's, I mean, this new one about puzzles was not so much from an article, it was just mostly just my greatest passion. I had actually started another book, which I still think is an interesting idea. It was all about misinformation and disinformation. It was called Fact Checking My Life. And I tried to fact check, you know, how do I know the world is round? I'm just taking someone's word for it. And how do I know, you know, my wife loves me? So it was really like almost epistemology. And it was pro-truth overall. The idea was, you know, there is a truth and we can get to it. It's hard and you really have to work at it, but there is a truth. Anyway, I worked on that for about 2 or 3 months, and it was so stressful for several reasons that in the end I said, what if I put that on hold and do something that I just love? And that is puzzles. And that is how that book came about.
God, I hope you go back to that. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I still think it's an interesting topic.
It's an amazing topic. Yeah.
It's very stressful though.
Yeah. All of your topics are very stressful. Your year of living biblically just totally stressed me out. I was like, that's hilarious. And also, watch out. Don't do that.
Oh man. Yeah. That was one of the hardest years of my life. It was fascinating, but it changed the way I dressed and I talked and I shaved and I interacted with my wife. It was just all encompassing.
Yeah. No, all of these projects, that's the theme. They feel all encompassing. It's very Do you feel like you're, because humor is also such a through line, you're so funny.
Humory.
This book felt a little, not less funny. I mean, it was still really funny, but there seems like there's a little more seriousness that's entered. And I don't know if that was project specific or if it was, you know, we're just growing up and we have to be adults and parents. And maybe,
yeah, that's an interesting question. I think my new book will, I hope, also be funny, but I do try to, you know, it's getting back to that old philosophy bachelors that you and I have and trying to wrestle with the big questions. So again, balancing, like we were saying earlier, zooming in and zooming out, but balancing between humor, the sort of the absurd and the sacred, the mundane and the profound.
Well, I just discovered that your podcast, which for philosophy nerds, I can't wait to check out, which is about right and wrong, right? You take two sides of an issue. As you said, that's been a fascination of yours to find the good and the bad. The good and bad of dogs.
Well, you are a good researcher. I will say that I still love the idea for that podcast, but I've been so swamped with writing my book that I haven't launched it. It was supposed to have been launched like a year ago. I still love the idea. Yeah, because everything has nuances. Everything has good and bad, including dogs. I love dogs. But the argument is, you know, dogs, for instance, dogs eat meat, so they eat other animals. So when you adopt a dog, you know, it's at the expense of 100 animals that he or she is going to eat over the lifetime. So what do you do with that? I still love my dog and there's no way I'm giving it away, but it's just something to grapple with.
Well, you've got a lot of work to do. So you have this book that I want you to write about fact-checking your life. You have this pod. I'm just going to sit in my closet as I do and wait for you to do all of this work so that I can read it.
I would be, well, anytime you want me back, 14 years from now or sooner, I would love to talk about any of the projects.
14 months from now. I love it. Is there anything we should have said, writing advice we should have said that we didn't? Favorite writing advice, worst writing advice you've ever gotten?
I'm reading right now, very slowly, but like a chapter every month or two, the Fight Club. Chuck Palahniuk, I found his writing book very interesting because he talked about how he tries to switch between the sort of declarative sentences like descriptions, and then he'll switch into commands like imperatives, like almost like he might list a recipe. And I thought that's an interesting, I never heard that. But just to mix it up, like we were talking earlier about how you want to zoom in and zoom out and weave in memoir with history. He's saying weave in different modes of speaking. So from description to command.
Are there books, kind of what kind of media do you yourself consume? Are you a huge reader? Do you consume mostly podcasts, or are there go-to things that you would recommend?
I listen to books. I read books. I listen to podcasts. I don't read podcasts. But I try to get some fiction in there because I do believe it's good for me. But the problem for me is when I'm writing a book like this one on puzzles, there's just so much I want to read about, because there's thousands of books. Like, you know, there's the history of mazes. There's the, the science of the aha moment. What's going on there? Oh, there's a new book coming out that I'm excited about by Paul Bloom, who's a Yale psychology professor, about why. It's called Sweet Spot, and it'll be out in the fall, I think. Why are we drawn to painful experiences? Like, why do we go to horror movies? Why do we run marathons? And why do we do crossword puzzles? So my problem is just there's so much I want to read whenever I'm writing a book that I don't have as much time to read sort of random, unrelated books.
It's your curiosity problem again, right?
Mm-hmm. I want to, exactly.
Yeah. Well, this was wonderful. We can follow you all over the place. If you put your name into Google, it doesn't stop. It just keeps going. But there's a great website, and you can follow all of that. And I will absolutely not wait 14 years to have you back. I will do it as soon as we possibly can.
Well, I had a great time, and I love the show, so I'm delighted to be on it.
That was A.J. Jacobs. The book, Thanks a Thousand, A Gratitude Journey, is out and available now. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.